welcome to Worlds Apart. Just a week apart, but miles away in tone and substance. The visits to China by the American and Russian presidents have showcased not only the drastic difference in political culture, but also the remarkable contrast in the notions of bilateral relationships and common good among the world's three great powers. What does this triangular act hold for the rest of the globe? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Patrick Henningsen, a writer and global affairs analyst. Mr. Henningsen, it's amazing to have you on the show. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you, Oksana.
Well, as you know, there's been a lot of rolling out of red carpets in Beijing over the past week. And while President Trump and President Putin may well have walked the same carpets, I wonder if you have noticed any difference in the reception or the overall atmosphere.
Yeah, it's a very revealing what's happened. I think it's a very significant moment in modern geopolitical history, because it's really signaling a changing of the guard, as it were, from the United States as being the sort of undisputed hegemon, has now sort of been relegated down from their perch. And the reception, obviously, the difference between Donald Trump's reception and the reception given by Vladimir Putin is clearly there's a much more tighter and cohesive and intimate relationship among Eurasian powers, because that's where the geopolitical center of gravity is shifting. That's where the economic center of gravity is shifting. That's where global capital is migrating eastward. And so that's kind of evident there in that relationship, and it's only going to get stronger. Donald Trump, on the other hand, I don't know what to describe this entourage, this massive entourage that he arrived with. And with really nothing in hand, prepared nothing, and it seemed like the Chinese weren't expecting much either. And this is a type of situation people are more or less getting used to with this presidency.
Many observers have noted the same thing, that Trump's visit was more about vibes and less about concrete details. But do vibes matter when it comes to the American president? And do you think it even makes sense to discuss any painstaking details with the current U.S. administration?
No, I think the Chinese are under no illusions that, much like Moscow and, of course, the Iranians have learned the hard way, don't expect anything substantive or anything productive to happen when you're interacting with this administration. It's going to be superficial. It's going to be performative. For Donald Trump, it was about the photo op. It was about the pageantry. It's about having that sort of video images strewn across U.S. media to show that he is the president of the United States and he's there with world leaders. That's why he also brought all the tech titans with him. He's kind of parlaying a favor to them by introducing him to the Chinese leadership. They'll owe him a favor in perpetuity for that. So type of influence peddling there. But I think they priced in the fact that there's no real diplomacy with this administration. They don't have the ability to. They don't have the personnel. And quite frankly, they don't really have any type of framework, diplomatic framework, to work within. First time ever in history for a U.S. government.
Well, the Chinese side seems to be more than willing to play along. For example, in his toast welcoming Trump to the official dinner, President Xi appeared to have drawn a parallel between Trump's Make America Great Again ethos and his own vision of China's great rejuvenation. Do you think these two agendas can coexist, not just in a toast, but in practical geopolitics?
No, I think it was a gracious gesture by Xi Jinping. It was magnanimous, but it was not really necessary, more to kind of pad the ego of this president. In reality, China's well aware the United States have entered a very dark phase in terms of their place in the global order. And they're sort of going through a piracy phase right now, breaking international law, breaking international conventions, treaties, to the point where everything is in disarray and chaos in terms of the international system as a result of the United States. And partly its partner Israel as well is a big part of this most recently. But I think the Chinese are under no illusion, and neither are the Russians. And again, neither is the leadership in Tehran. They've learned to price all of this in with the U.S. It's really about managing the U.S. and getting from A to B and not having any big problems. But in terms of getting anything productive done and making any serious headway, it's not going to happen with this presidency.
Well, speaking about long-term commitments, President Trump was very effusive in his praise of the Chinese leader, and he said that the two nations have a fantastic future together. But we all remember last year's bickering over the tariffs. If we try to land Trump's Beijing praise within the broader bilateral and global context, how long do you think this good feel, good vibe is going to last?
There's a lot of political pressure in the United States, as you know, different system. There's a lot of pressure to be more hawkish against China. Certainly the defense industry really wants to keep the Taiwan situation simmering at a good temperature because that's going to net great returns in terms of defense. You saw the commitment to sell, over $100 billion in arms to the Taiwanese, and all of that is just grist for the mill for Wall Street and the defense stocks. But in the reality isn't there. Strategically, the United States, the bottom just fell out of any ambitions they might have had vis-a-vis Taiwan with all those ambitions sunk in the Persian Gulf. China is probably very confident, realizing the United States is a spent force in terms of its military prowess, being able to prosecute a war so far from home as they've had in the Persian Gulf, with the benefit of all of those U.S. bases around the Persian Gulf, which now are mostly abandoned. They don't have nearly that type of support structure in East Asia, not intimately around Taiwan anyway. So it's straining a lot of the geopolitical thinking in Washington now, and I think a lot of realities have now come to the surface that's very hard to ignore.
And yet I think the Chinese were also very successful in making sure that the American side pledges its support to this so-called constructive strategic stability ethos that both sides have actually voiced. I think the Chinese are far more enthusiastic about it than the Americans, but the White House too has put out a statement about it. Do you think the two sides at this point of time understand this notion of constructive stability or strategic stability in the same way, or at least roughly similar?
They may be. There may be some people in the Trump administration that might be able to get their head around this, but increasingly we find this chronic problem with this administration in that they're devoid of any real strategic thinking. And Donald Trump is somebody who often confuses tactics with strategy. You often hear this with Trump, that he's into transactional diplomacy. All that is basically just a dog whistle for tactics. The other one is he's unpredictable, and that's part of his strategy. That's not a strategy. That's a tactic. Unfortunately, a lot of these tropes have fed Donald Trump's ego and the collective ego of the White House, and they kind of run with it. It's their brand, but it's totally counterproductive in terms of international relations.
Well, speaking about coherence, this issue of consistency or trustworthiness has been a major challenge for any nation trying to build a predictable relationship with the United States, because the Americans have long maintained that they are not to be hamstrung by any international agreements and can break any deals as they see fit. Do you think there will ever come a time when Washington may believe authentically, genuinely, that it is in its interest to protect and uphold international law and play by the same rules as everyone else?
Those days are behind us, unfortunately. You know, if you look at the whole framework of international law, and specifically post-World War II, all the international institutions, from the United Nations right through to the World Trade Organization, and we can even throw NATO in there, all of these are basically byproducts of a post-war order. And that framework was designed in a reaction to what happened during those wars, and who's declared the victor of those wars will determine what seats, and with nuclear powers, that's another special club as well that determines the hierarchy in the international system. The United States built that system, and the United States managed to leverage that for total global power after the Second World War, so it was in their interest, even though they would sidestep international law, but they would still have to go through the effort of consensus building through the institutions. What you have now is they've totally abandoned any pretense of wanting to put in the effort to try to get consensus or, quote, buy-in from the international community. They're just going ahead and doing it in this sort of hyper-realist sort of Hobbesian fashion. And unfortunately, the problem, Oksana, is this is going to lead to that war. And it's going to ultimately upend the international system, much like it has in previous points in history before major wars. And then someone, whoever declares himself to be the winner, will sweep up the ashes and rebuild an international system.
Now, speaking about wars, I heard you say in another interview that all the American incursions and invasions notwithstanding, the current Iranian conflict is something completely different. In what way?
Well, first of all, this is different because it's quite obvious that another country, a foreign entity that has managed to capture the political system in the United States, we're talking about the Israel lobby, has been really the driving force behind this. And you can talk about grand strategy and all the rest of it, but a few would argue that if you look at what the United States has lost in terms of military assets and bases as a result of this undeclared war of aggression, it's hard to make the argument that this was good for U.S. empire. In fact, it's accelerated just the opposite. However, it was imperative for the survival of the Netanyahu government and the state of Israel that does have expansionist plans, which is no secret right now. So that's what makes this, I think, different from other wars. And the other thing that we can't ignore, this is the first time a country has struck back at the United States directly and in a major way. And that's never happened. Iran has gone toe-to-toe with the United States in a way that no other country has, really, unless you count the Second World War. We could argue about the context of those sort of arguments, but and they're still standing. Not only that, they've also taken the most severe blows from Israel, which is a powerful conventional military. So that's a different world we're living in now. This has never happened. And you can see how that's transforming the power dynamics of West Asia, of the Middle East, as they call it.
Not only Iran is still standing, I think they have acquired a major leverage, not only over Trump and Netanyahu, but over the entire global system. I'm talking about the Strait of Hormuz, which reportedly was discussed during Trump's visit to Beijing. And it's been said by the White House that the two leaders agreed on reopening the Strait of Hormuz. Do you find it credible, and do you find it even implementable?
I take any claims or statements made by this White House with a pinch of salt. For all we know, it could have been a conversation Donald Trump had in his own head at some point that he translated into a claim that China said this or that. And China did not confirm such things, among other claims that were made after the fact by Trump and his team, that China did not confirm were spoken about. So besides the imaginary conversations, it's really media fodder. It's another political tactic that Donald Trump does, where he kind of like invents talking points and narratives in order to somehow, desperate for a win, but equally desperate to conceal defeat, because he had taken such a strong position beforehand that we're going to go in there and China is going to do this for us and do that. And he's come out pretty much empty-handed. So it's not credible, and half of these claims by Trump.
Well, Mr. Henningsen, what is credible is that we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned.
We need to counter the Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
And what planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Patrick Henningsen, a writer and global affairs analyst. Now, Mr. Henningsen, hot on the heels of President Trump, Russian President Vladimir Putin arrived in China, also flanked by a very large delegation. And I know that Putin's visit to China had been planned for many months prior, and it is actually time to coincide with the 25th anniversary of the strategic treaty that Russia and China signed all those years back. Now, do you think such long-term relationships make any sense in this pretty chaotic and pretty transactional era?
There's definitely a Eurasian shift, which we talked about before. You're not merely dealing with two economic superpowers, an energy superpower in Russia, but geopolitically, undeniably, these are superpowers. But this is more of a civilizational meeting of the minds. These are two well-established civilizational states. And I think that's what's significant here. So there's more than just military strategy or cooperation. It's really about coexistence, and it's about mapping a future together. And whether that what shape that takes and what framework people use to articulate that, multipolarism is certainly something that a lot of people are talking about regarding the new world order that everybody is searching for, or this is somehow to define the relations between countries. But beyond that, I think it's not a short-term relationship between Russia and China, and they realize they do have to stick together. They both need each other, and any sort of illusions that there would be, you know, any opportunities westward for either of these countries that they could really bank on, I think that those days are long gone.
Well, you put it in civilizational terms. I would offer a rather more profane metaphor, perhaps. I think it's a bit like the difference between speed dating and sustained marriage, because both have their thrills and their challenges, but ultimately both rely on and develop different skill sets. And I think an argument could be made that such a sustained relationship, bilateral relationship, could only be supported or maintained by countries with continuous leadership, and that many so-called democratic systems with fast-changing governments could simply not sustain this type of diplomacy simply because they prefer to use foreign policy as a convenient distraction from domestic pressures. What do you think about that?
There's a lot to be said for that. I mean, the longer you're in power, the better chance you have to implement your agenda. So in the democratic West, you know, we change our monarchs every 4 years, and we convince ourselves how democratic we are. But the problem is they spend the three of their 4 year terms raising money for the next election. And and also you have special interests and lobbies that have more or less taken over the democratic system. So what started as democracy in the West has morphed into something completely different. And I think we're at the end of that, what Strauss and Howell might call the fourth turning. We're sort of at the tail end of the utility of this. Now, there's there's a lot of questions regarding the utility versus the risk of a multipolar world. Certainly, this is an ongoing debate because we're really talking about a concept, multipolarism. But what is undeniable is that the spirit behind the multipolar world conversation, behind BRICS, is that about cooperation? Is that about respect? Is that about what's going to define relations between countries? And not so much in the sort of post-World War II hierarchy that's been constructed really around U.S. and Western dominance globally, financially, politically, militarily, under all of these categories. Now we're into potentially a potential reset. The question is, what's going to happen during that reset? How much damage could potentially be done during this transition period? And what are the risks?
Mm-hmm. Now, I hear some of perhaps doubt about the idea of a multipolar world being able to be scaled to other countries. And I think this concept has been around for quite some time, for over a decade, but it's been rather slow in making the transition from speeches to actual politics, partly because there are not too many countries who are able or willing to withstand Western pressure. Why do you think Xi and Putin decided to bring it up again and at this particular historical moment?
Well, the risks are, I was quite surprised to see Xi Jinping mention Thucydides' trap during his statement with the U.S. delegation in the room. And he's obviously opining on a level of historical and geopolitical concepts that might be going over the head of a lot of the people in the U.S. team. Maybe Marco Rubio might be able to sort of understand what that sort of is, but forget about Trump, Pete Hegseth, or the rest of them. They have no idea what Xi Jinping's talking about. What he's talking about there is the risk of an empire in decline and then a rising power, and how historically, according to many philosophers and geopolitical analysts and academics, that is going to risk triggering this, what they call Thucydides' trap, and where that dying hegemon will lash out to prevent the rise of another power. Marco Rubio said it himself on his way to China. He said, China can't be allowed to rise if the U.S. falls. Well, quite frankly, the U.S. is going to fall no matter what. They're carrying $40 trillion in debt, and the economy has been sucked dry, mainly by the people on Air Force One with Trump and his entourage, all the central bankers and the captains of industry that have been getting rich off of government deficit spending largesse. So U.S. has only itself to blame if it's a declining power. The problem is there is a collective ego there and quite a lot of capabilities and power still in hand with the U.S. They could do a lot of damage on their way out.
You know, what I find curious is that while both Russian and Chinese leaders are talking a lot about the multipolar world and how exploitative the Western system is, they've also both have invested a lot of personal effort into cultivating an amicable relationship with Donald Trump. Do you think it's genuine, or what do you make of it?
Well, I think it is genuine. I think the Russian position, Sergei Lavrov, and you have a real diplomatic core that's been there for a long time. There's a lot of continuity. Same in China, same in Iran. They always leave the door open. You have to leave the door open when you're dealing with a hegemon with such incredible military power that is slightly unstable at the moment. You have to always leave the door open for genuine diplomacy. If you don't, because it sends a message to the rest of the world and allows you to at least occupy the moral high ground. What you don't want to do is have other countries bandwagoning against China, Russia, and Iran. So they're in a little bit of a problem there. They still have to humor the global superpower while it's in its decline in order to try to manage the situation. It's about managing the chaos around Donald Trump rather than getting any specific or constructive things done. And that's the way I'm kind of conceptualizing this dynamic right now with these relationships.
Mm-hmm. Now, some officials in Russia go as far as to praise Trump for understanding, recognizing the counterproductiveness of the U.S. sanctions and on Russian oil and lifting them, at least for the duration of the Iranian crisis, I should add. Do you think that's indeed an act of sort of analytical reassessment and the reversal of policy, on the part of the Trump administration, as opposed to just a self-serving, opportunistic move that can be turned around any moment?
I think more, I would agree with more the latter. I wouldn't bank very much on any kind of strategic acumen here on the part of this administration. They're just really trying to make the numbers add up. Certainly with the global price of oil, supply and demand, managing that situation, not to mention you have a tremendous problem in the U.S., especially with this administration, with insider trading on the global oil futures market, as well as the S&P 500, on the stock market, statements being linked to market swings, statements by the president, bets placed by members of his inner circle. All of these things are currently being investigated right now. So you do have that element as well. But I think it is true that slightly more amicable relations with Russia and the United States than between the U.S. and Iran, for instance. But I wouldn't put too much into that because, you know, the United States is doing a lot to undermine Russia with regards to its continued support for Ukraine on so many different levels. But it's not just the support for Ukraine. It's the inability to try to do anything to ameliorate or to mitigate or to bring that conflict to a close. Trump campaigned that he would do it in 24 hours. Well, here we are. In terms of the U.S. brokering an end to that conflict, I don't think that's even possible at this point.
Well, I think with this kind of quote-unquote policy, the United States is trying to undermine not only Russia, but it's also directly undermining its own prospects, and not only on the Ukrainian front. For example, due to the oil sales that you mentioned, Russia emerges one of the main direct benefactors, or beneficiaries rather, of the conflict in Iran, and also in military terms, with most of the U.S. bases in the Middle East now damaged, severely damaged, and with no clear prospects of being rebuilt, the balance of conventional power in the world is already shifting away from the Americans, with no contribution of either Russia or China. How much longer do you think the United States can afford to shoot themselves in the foot in such a manner?
Well, what you're mentioning there, all of these trends have been accelerated by the Trump administration. They're accelerating the flight from the U.S. dollar, the de-dollarization trends, the move away from the petrodollar, what you're saying in terms of the balance of conventional force. All of these are basically byproducts of a Trump administration pushing too hard, pushing too bullshy and too fast, and without really any thought going into the consequences, and also not understanding what are the true roots and what is the basis of American power. American power, after World War II, has been through all of these institutions that Trump has undermined and is attacking, even the UN, for instance. So and there's just a lack of understanding on this, and I think that's one of the fundamental intellectual problems with MAGA, America First, and all these talking points that really don't really describe the world as it actually is in terms of actual U.S. power.
Well, but this didn't start with Trump. And you noted once that with Donald Trump, obviously everything is about the news cycle, but it has been sort of the American obsession with media framing and perception that supposedly Trump's reality. I mean, that has been an American trope for quite some time. And I think that's also even painful to witness for many of us here, how the very powerful country's policy is being totally undermined by this obsession with things that don't even exist. Do you think that's likely to change after Trump is gone?
That's the big fear, you know, and the problem with the U.S. has a certain pattern is that whenever there's a lot of power accumulated in one place in the U.S., be it the executive branch or be it in the military, that power remains. So while things were done that looked like they were a response to some kind of crisis, the government power and wherever the concentration of power, it stays. So the Democrat administration could come in right after Trump and not pick up where he'd left off, maybe change the style. But, you know, previous administrations have done pretty outlandish things. Under the Joe Biden administration, that's really where the death of diplomacy began. But we could even track back even further. Donald Trump 1.0, Barack Obama, a lot of these things we see, Trump's a byproduct of, I think, a gradual process of corruption in the United States and not just the corruption in terms of government or corporate corruption or special interests, but an intellectual corruption. And they've lost control of the narrative of the United States and its place in the world. And that's the real crisis. Mm-hmm. That's where the real power actually lies.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've lost control of the narrative that wasn't accurate in the first place. But I guess we will have to put a stop here. Mr. Henningsen, thank you very much for sharing your analysis with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you next week on Worlds Apart.